Well, in 1859, one of the most landmark moments happened in our acquisition of modern knowledge as Charles Darwin published his magisterial work, The Origin of the Species, the great Victorian biologist. And in that book, Darwin proposed a powerful scientific account of why we see the world in the way that we do. We look at a world and we see these countless species, these multitude of living creatures that all seem to share certain things in common and yet are wildly different from each other in their structure for life and their kinds and so on. And Darwin proposed a theory of natural selection leading to the evolution of the vast variety of the life that we see today. In that book, Darwin didn't propose or didn't address the issue of human origins, but his theory was soon developed by him and others in that way, and so the theory of evolution soon became a powerful account, not just of species, as we see in the animal world, but of human origins, a powerful scientific account of the story of how it is that we came to be human. Now, of course, Darwin was not the first person to consider human origins and to take an interest in the origins of life. From the ancient Greek myths to the various religions to traditional cultures and secular theories of politics and society, it seems that whenever humans set themselves to seriously think about who we are and what we are for, they cannot help and we cannot help but reflect on origins. To understand who we are, to understand who we are supposed to be, to understand what has gone wrong and what we need to do about it, it seems that human minds and human cultures are drawn and have been drawn for thousands of years to think about where we came from. Because where we came from, our origins seem to promise within them where we should go. To understand our origins seems to promise to open up our future. Now, in that way, the Bible is no different. The Bible seeks to understand those sorts of questions. The Bible is a book about who we are. It's a book that has something powerful to say about what went wrong, about what we need to do to fix it, and what our future and our purpose is. And like the other books and stories that I've mentioned, the Bible does what we all do, which is to go back to the origins, back to the beginning, in a search for the answers to the questions that perplex humans. And it's that those stories of our beginnings, of our origins, that will occupy us for the next few weeks in the city, and I hope you can keep coming and join us and bring friends along who might be interested in these things. And we start where everyone should start, at the beginning of the Bible, with this magnificent chapter, Genesis chapter 1. And I wanted to use that really as a kickoff into the series and to think about this great chapter in three ways, briefly, as literature, as history, and as theology. What does this chapter say about as literature? What kind of writing is it? What does it say about history, about the world out there? And what does it say as theology? What does it say about us and our relationship to God? So firstly, literature. When we read, as we just have, Genesis chapter 1, there for you on your outline, what exactly is it that we're reading? What sort of text are we confronted with? Well, I hope as you heard it read, we're confronted with a song. The opening of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, is a song of celebration and praise. It's a song, but it's not like any song you could ever imagine singing. You can't think of the chords or the melody that would go with this song. So it's a song, but it's a kind of a poem. But again, it's not like any poem we've read before. It hasn't got a flowery structure. It's not rich with metaphor and simile. And it doesn't even follow the conventions of normal Hebrew poetry, the kind that you would find in the Psalms and so on. And so it's a song and it's a poem, but it's almost a kind of liturgy. If you've ever been to a church or to a religious service, those points in services where there's a response, reader and response from the front, and there's different parts given almost like a play. The Genesis chapter 1 reads like that. Those repetitions of, and it was so, and it was good, and God said. It moves you rhythmically through the creation on that six-day cycle. It's like liturgy, and it's history. It's telling us something about the world, but again, it doesn't read like history in the conventional sense. Indeed, I think part of the greatness of this chapter and why it's worth thinking about in the 21st century in the middle of the CBD of Perth is that it defies almost any genre that you try to put it in. It's song, but it's history, and it's also poetry and theology and liturgy. Whatever else this great opening of the Bible is, it is a prologue. Whatever else it is the beginning, the overture to the great story of the Bible, the point at which the Bible writers want us to begin as we think about everything else that they say in the light of this great prologue and overture. Genesis chapter 1, as Paul read, begins like this: "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." It's interesting to note that the Bible doesn't begin with an argument. The Bible doesn't begin with this premise and this premise and then this conclusion follows. It does that elsewhere, but here it just begins not with argument but with statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's worth us knowing as 21st century readers that the Bible wasn't the first book or the only book in the ancient world to account for the heavens and the earth. There are many other stories that we have from the ancient world, Mesopotamia and elsewhere, about where the world came from. Some of them talked about gods sleeping with other gods and the world was a product of their union. Other stories talked about the way the sea or the trees or the rocks became gods. And still others about how gods demarcated the creation, and some gods were responsible for the wind and others for the rain and others for the sea and so on. And against that background, this is so different. Because here you just have one God who is the source and origin of everything that was made. One God created, uncreated, unmade, unborn, who creates the heavens and the earth. Heavens and the earth is a biblical way of saying kind of from Yanship to Mandurah. It's just a way of including everything that's in between. The heavens is everything out there and earth is everything in here. And the Bible beginning like that introduces us to that fundamental part of the Christian worldview. That according to the Bible, there are really only two sections of reality. There is God and there is everything that God has made. God and everything he has made. That is a profound worldview. We're used to it in the Western culture, but consider the alternatives. One of the popular creation myths at the time said that the earth was a product of a war between a great sea monster called Tiamat, and the sea monster was slain by these warring gods, and the heavens and the earth were the creation of the carcass of the body of the great sea monster. Or consider the view of the modern secular view, that the world is not a creation, it has no creator. It has no one behind it, no personality, no purpose that brought it into being. Or consider a spiritual worldview, an animistic worldview, that every plant and flower are animated by various gods and demons and angels and so on. Genesis is so different. It's not the product of a war. It's not the product of competing gods. It's not the product of a purposeless and pitiless process. It is the product of one God who made all things. Now, you can get that from just Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. You would have that whole Christian understanding of a world created by God. But the story goes on, and you notice that in verses, really from verse 5, if you look at your sheet, all the way down, it's not a process so much of just raw creation. Everything's been created, the heavens and the earth, in the first section. The process that follows is really a process of distinction and blessing. You see there, he says, God, on the first day, God distinguishes light from darkness, and he calls that distinction good. Or on the second day, God creates the sky, and he distinguishes the sky from the land, and he calls that distinction good. And then you notice he separates the water from the land, and having separated them, he calls that distinction good. And then on days 4 to 6, notice days 1 to 3, he creates the spaces for life, the heavens, the sea, and the land. And then in days 4 to 6, God populates the spaces that he has created with the things that are to live there. So he fills the earth with animals, he fills the sea with sea creatures, he fills the sky with birds. The process is one of creation and then distinction, and then he fills the spaces he's distinguished, and then he blesses them and says that they are good. The diversity that we see in our world, according to the Bible, is not the product of fallenness, but the purpose of God. The sea is not the land. The land is not the sea. The sea is not the sky. They are distinguished from each other, and the freedom of creation is that they are distinguished to be the places where life experiences its freeness and flourishing. Fish are at their very best when they're at their fishiest. Trees do their best work when they are most like trees. The sky is not a prison in which God enclosed the birds, but the proper place where they can express their nature. Just as a fish that makes a sudden bid for the land in an effort to be freed from the prison of the sea will soon realize that the sea was not a prison, but rather the context for its freedom. God creates this world of space and population and order and purpose. And then on the sixth day, at the apex of his creative work, he creates humanity. One thing, one species in two forms, man and woman, who are set at the center of creation to bear God's image, to remind the creation of the God in heaven, and to bear witness to what he is like. You see that process that God has of being able to speak, and the thing that he speaks is exactly as he wanted it to be. I remember a few years ago on ABC, I saw an interview with Woody Allen, the great filmmaker. And Woody Allen was talking about his creative process, and he said that that every time he invented a film, he does it on his bed. So he sits on his bed like a kind of teenage girl and sits there and thinks about the film that he wants and starts writing the script. And he talked about his creative process, and he said that at the beginning of every film, it's Citizen Kane. Every film that he starts is going to be perfect. And Woody Allen says that 9 times out of 10, something happens between what he spoke and the film that eventually ends up in the cinemas. And he's always disappointed because the film as executed is never the film that he imagined. And I guess most of us who have been doing an honest morning's work so far have had that experience, and we have it most days, where there's the thing that we intend to be and we imagine what that process, what that report, what that building, what that project would look like. And so often, somewhere in the process of our imagination and our execution, the thing is not as we wanted it to be. And you know that because every so often it is. And every so often you have a day at work that is every bit as hard as the day that you had at work yesterday. But on that particular day, 1 in 100 or 1 in 50 or perhaps once a year, the thing that you wanted to happen happened almost exactly. You don't go home tired, you go home elated because you've experienced something of what God experienced as he spoke the world into being. Well, I thought about Genesis as literature. I wanted to think briefly before we finish of it as history and finally as theology. In the last 200 years, a debate has raged, as you know, over the relationship between science and the Bible. And so what do we have to say at this point? Well, it seems to me that because of the kind of literature this is, because of the way it's written and the way these truths are presented to us, Genesis chapter 1 is not a passage that demands us to read it as history in the straightforward sense of an eyewitness account of what happened. It seems to me that all the indications of reading it, the poetry of the account, the structure, details like night and day existing in days 1, 2, and 3, although the sun and the moon don't appear till well into the story, or chapter 2, verse 4, which says that the creation happened in a single day, although here we talk about the days, or the relationship between chapters 1 and chapter 2, which are quite different in their details. It seems to me that on an impartial reading of this passage, it screams at us to say, I'm not science, I'm celebration. I'm not here to answer the question how, I'm here to help you celebrate the experience of being in a world of variety and order and purpose, a world created by God. I don't think that it's science or history in the conventional sense, but it does have something to say about science and history. I think what it says is that raw thing that we've seen, that the world is good and that it's the product of a wise and loving creator. I want to ask you three questions, and one or the other might strike you more powerfully. Firstly, if you're convinced that this world is not created, that the processes of science are complete in their explanation and no further explanation is needed, no further God is needed, I just want to ask at the beginning of the series, are you sure? Are you sure that science is not only a necessary but a sufficient account of what it is to be human and what it is to be in this world? As you look at the world in all its stunning beauty and order, as you think about the experience of being human, are you sure there is no creator? There are many people who are deeply involved in science who also deeply believe in a creator. John Polkinghorne of Cambridge University, Francis Collins, the head of the Genome Project, Anthony Flew, a lifelong atheist who recently was persuaded on the basis of the evidence that there must be something behind the creation of the universe. If you don't believe there's a creator, I want to begin the series by just saying, are you sure? But secondly, it may be that you've always taken these chapters to be completely metaphorical, completely poetry, with no grounding in history at all. And I want to say, are you sure? Because the rest of the Bible leans heavily on Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3. Much of what the Bible says about who God is and who we are rests on the fact that these chapters are pointing to something real in the real world. Can you dismiss them so quickly as mythology or just poetry with no reference beyond themselves? But finally, if you do think these chapters put Christianity on a direct collision course with modern science, then I want to ask you, are you so sure? Before the theory of evolution was ever on the scene or ever dreamt of, people like Philo, the great Jewish scholar, people like Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, all understood Genesis chapter 1 as not being a scientific account of how, but a celebratory account of why. And today, the vast majority of Christians, the teaching of the Orthodox and Catholic churches, and a majority of Protestant scholars, John Stott, Gordon Wenham, Peter Jensen, B.B. Warfield, Tim Keller, and others, have seen in this chapter no conflict with science, but rather a complementary account, calling us to understand different things and to tell different truths to the truths that science is equipped to tell us. Well, I guess I'm just saying on all those things, keep an open mind on what these chapters may reveal to us about God and his creation. The great Catholic theologian G.K. Chesterton once said that an open mind is a good thing, but an open mind is only a good thing if it clamps down on something nourishing. Otherwise, an open mind just becomes a sewer that lets anything pass through it. And so in the weeks that follow, I'm noticing the time, in the weeks that follow, I want us to think deeply together about the theology of these chapters, about what they teach us about God and ourselves, our society and our creation. And I think it's a very exciting and exhilarating task. So I look forward to joining you in that over the next few weeks. But we did promise time for questions, so I'm going to stop there.
All right. Thank you, Rory.